This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. Russia and Syria launched airstrikes Saturday on Syria's last rebel stronghold of Idlib, killing at least four civilians in what a war monitoring group said were the most intense attacks in a month. The Syrian Observatory for Human Rights said aircraft carried out about 60 raids in less than 3 hours on southern areas of the densely populated stronghold. As military attacks on Idlib intensify, the United Nations is trying to put the Syrian conflict on the political negotiating table. Senior officials from Russia, Turkey, and Iran will gather in Geneva Monday for 2 days of discussions on drafting a new constitution for war-torn Syria. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from the site of the talks.
UN Special Envoy for Syria, Stefan de Mistura, views these talks as the curtain raiser on a renewed political process for Syria. The aim is to help this conflict-ridden country transition to a more democratic society. De Mistura says the focus of the two-day meeting will be to establish a Syrian-led and Syrian-owned constitutional committee. The task of the committee will be to rewrite the Syrian constitution, paving the way for new elections.
But we have reached a point, due to many circumstances and realpolitik, that the Constitution Committee can be and should be now the entry point for what we call a credible political process, as long as the Constitution Committee is credible as well.
And that is a major sticking point.
Lee Schlein for VOA News. A district police chief was among dozens of security forces killed in Afghanistan in overnight attacks by the Taliban. Separately, reports said a coordinated Taliban attack against army and police posts in a troubled district has killed at least 20 Afghan security forces. U.S.-trained Afghan national defense and security forces have struggled to contain the Taliban there. This is VOA News. Supporters of jailed opposition leader Alexei Navalny are staging protests across Russia over plans to increase the nation's pension age as Russians go to the polls for regional elections. Navalny was scheduled to appear Sunday at the demonstration in Moscow, but last month he was convicted of breaking protest laws and jailed for 30 days. His supporters, however, went forward with the plans for the protest. The demonstrations have not been sanctioned by the government. Swedes began voting on Sunday in an election dominated by fears over asylum and welfare and the anti-immigration Sweden Democrats vying to become the biggest party in a country long seen as a bastion of economic stability and liberal values. Saskia O'Donoghue with Reuters reports.
Polls opening in Sweden on Sunday in a tight election dominated by fears over asylum and welfare. A far-right and fiercely populist political party is poised to decide the balance of power in the normally progressive country. The anti-immigration Sweden Democrats are vying to become the biggest party. And while that's unlikely, polls suggest they'll win less than 20% of the votes, that figure is still enough to render them as kingmakers.
That is Saskia O'Donoghue reporting. Former U.S. President Barack Obama on Saturday told attendees at a Democratic rally that the United States government is a government for everybody, not for sale. Obama has maintained a low public profile since leaving office, but with midterm elections coming in November, he spoke Saturday at an Anaheim, California rally in support of Democratic candidates and districts won by Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton in 2016. On Fox News Sunday, Vice President Mike Pence was critical of the former president.
It was very disappointing to see President Obama break with the tradition of former presidents and become so political and roll out the same tired arguments that he and liberals have made over the last 8 years.
But Chris Coons, a U.S. senator from the state of Delaware, defended Obama.
He has stayed completely on the sidelines for 18 months. From what I heard of President Obama, former President Obama's speech, his core message was that we need to do a better job of listening to each other, respecting each other, and honoring our institutions and traditions.
Also on Fox News Sunday, Vice President Pence called on the anonymous senior official carrying out inside resistance to the Trump administration to do the honorable thing and resign. He told Fox News Sunday that the official who wrote an op-ed opinion article in the New York Times last week that called Trump immoral was literally violating an oath, not to the president, but to the Constitution, by seeking to undermine Trump's presidency. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington.
People are hungry. People are demanding for change. They're demanding for change because they feel that the government is not giving them the right security.
Hecklers blame Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni over increasing insecurity concerns.
So when you look at the distance, they were convicted with the killing of a number of people from security forces during the dispersal. But when you look at the case files itself, they don't point to someone saying that this person killed that.
An Egyptian court sentences 75 people to death.
Let's not destroy one we cannot produce nor make. Children cannot even go to school. That's the mercy on your people.
Hundreds of Cameroonian women protest the ongoing violence in their communities. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Ugandans are expressing concern about growing insecurity in the country. This following the murder of a senior police officer, Mohamed Kirumira, on the outskirts of the capital, Kampala, Saturday. Police have launched an investigation into the murder of their colleague. Meanwhile, President Yoweri Museveni was heckled when he went to the crime scene. The hecklers say the president has failed to protect life and property as mandated by the Constitution. For the latest development, I reach Andrew Bagala, crimes reporter for the Daily Monitor, a major Ugandan newspaper.
At around 9 p.m. East African time, an assistant inspector and assistant superintendent of police, Mohamed Kirumira, was down. He was driving his car with a lady who is said to be his friend. Both were shot as they were driving by armed men who used a motorcycle. After the shooting, the armed men fled the scene. Right now, police still trying to find out who really carried out the shooting. They right now have no clues, but they are looking at the bullets, the cartridge that remained at the scene to see if it was the same gun which was used in the previous shooting that happened in Kampala.
So, Andrew, we understand President Museveni was at the scene of the crime and he was heckled. Why was he heckled?
He went to the scene to see what had happened and then talk to the people. But the residents around feel that he hasn't done a lot to curb crime in the country. And he was heckled. He was called a nickname, this is called Bosco. So they were telling him that they love Bobby Wine, who is a young MP called, that is his stage name, but his right name is Robert Kyagulanyi. So they were saying that they want Kyagulanyi to take power from him. It's the reason why they were shouting at him. They were shouting, people power, Bobby Wine, Kyagulanyi.
This is not the first time such a crime has happened in such mode where motorcycles appear to have been involved and machine guns and all that. Why is this going on and why hasn't the government been able to do anything to resolve this? Don't forget also that there was a recent surge in the murder of businesswomen or prominent women in Kampala and beyond.
They have all these cases, the police and other security agencies claim to be investigating, and they have taken some people to court. But recently, this week, the people who are taken to court over such cases, the charges were dropped. These people were involved in the murder, were accused of murdering the former spokesperson of police. Even in the recent cases, none of those cases, those cases that they have arrested suspects. So they are just telling us that we should be united, believing them that at one time they will arrest the suspects.
But do Ugandans believe the police, in spite of the assurances they're giving about them working hard to arrest the perpetrators? Because I understand the growing insecurity is worrying, and that people are saying if a police officer or police officers could be killed in such manner, then how safe are they?
The worry is that no suspects have been arrested, and most of these people who have been killed have had rangos within the agencies they work in, especially these police officers. There are other issues that the women who were killed were close to areas that security agencies, people from security agencies usually have good time, especially in the evening. So the people are hungry. People are demanding for change. They're demanding for change because they feel that the government is not giving them the right security. And that's why you find that even the people who in the security agencies, the number of police officers or soldiers who are protecting them has increased. So it's the fear that has gone around the entire country. Even you can see it in Jam, everyone has a list with officers with automatic rifles, sharpshooters, and even commandos who are moving them to ensure that they are protected. So people are wondering, why are those few given security when the entire community, the entire society is suffering from crime?
Andrew Bagala is a crimes reporter for the Daily Monitor, a major Ugandan newspaper. He spoke with me from the capital, Kampala. An Egyptian court has sentenced 75 people to death, including several prominent Muslim Brotherhood leaders and 47 other people to life in prison over the bloody dispersal of two Muslim Brotherhood sit-in camps in 2013. The sentence, however, is not final and is expected to be appealed. For VOA, Edward Uranian reports from the Egyptian capital, Cairo.
There was little suspense in the courtroom as the verdicts were handed down because it was clear to observers that the sentences were not final and will no doubt be appealed. Human rights groups, including Amnesty International, condemned the trial, calling it disgraceful and against the country's constitution. Hussein Baoumi, who is based in Tunisia and covers Egypt for Amnesty, told VOA that the trials were not carried out fairly and clear evidence was not presented against individuals for the crimes with which they were charged.
The trial has generally been unfair. When you look at the death sentence, they were convicted with the killing of a number of people from security forces during the dispersal. But when you look at the case file itself, they don't point to someone saying that this person killed that person. It doesn't identify the point where the criminal action took place.
Amnesty also criticizes the Egyptian government for not holding anyone from the country's security forces responsible for the close to 900 deaths at the camps. Egypt's parliament passed a law earlier this year exonerating the military and police for actions during the 2013 protests in the Rabah and Al-Nahda areas of Cairo. Saeed Sadiq, who teaches political sociology, tells VOA that the government insists that security force members were attacked and killed by protesters first, and security forces were deemed to be acting in self-defense. Sadiq believes that it is unlikely that death sentences will be carried out in the recent series of mass trials, and that the government is holding them mostly as part of its anti-terrorism strategy.
Egypt, like many countries, when they fight terrorism, they usually adopt three steps. One is to eliminate leadership, either by imprisonment, exile, Second strategy is to cut the finances, as this had been taking place by confiscating and suspending any company that used to provide money for the Muslim Brotherhood. Third strategy is to criminalize membership in any of those terrorist organizations.
Many observers who are following the case of prominent photojournalist Mahmoud Abu Zaid, known to the media as Shaukan, were relieved to learn that he was given a fairly light 5-year sentence and is likely to be freed for time served. Hundreds of people were arrested after Egyptian security forces stormed 2 Muslim Brotherhood sit-in camps in August 2013, several months after the military ousted Islamist President Mohamed Morsi after weeks of protests against him. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
Hundreds of women were on the streets of Bamenda, an English-speaking town in northwestern Cameroon, to protest the violence in their communities. In an emotionally charged event Friday, they called on the government and armed separatists to drop their guns and engage in meaningful dialogue for peace. For VOA, Moki Edwin Kenzeka was there and has this report from Bamenda.
37-year-old Eta Ernestine cries as she tells a crowd of hundreds of women that she lost her husband in the war in the English-speaking regions of Cameroon 2 weeks ago and does not know how she will be able to bring up their 3 children. She says she has seen students, drivers, farmers, civil servants and cattle ranchers killed. The women are crying and saying that it is time for dialogue to be held to put an end to the bloodshed. Among them is 42-year-old Kamela Ito, who says she wants the world to know she has lost her only baby and husband, that her residence was torched by either the military or armed fighters 3 months ago in the northwestern town of Bengui. She begs for the carnage to stop.
Let's not destroy one we cannot produce nor make. Children cannot even go to school. That you have mercy on your people.
In November 2017, President Paul Biya declared war on people he called secessionists, after armed men attacked and killed policemen and soldiers in English-speaking southwestern Cameroon. Cameroon reports that about 300 civilians and more than 100 soldiers and policemen have been killed since then. At least 130 schools have been torched and 100 villages razed. Pamela Munti came out to ask for peace to return because she lost her parents in the war in January in the southwestern town of Lebialem. She says both government forces and the armed separatists have been committing atrocities and should drop their guns to allow peace to return.
We are willing to cleanse our land. We are willing for the children who have died in the bushes. We are wailing for our husbands who are in the military. We are wailing for everyone who has died.
Cameroon Communication Minister and government spokesperson Issa Chiruma says the government cannot withdraw its troops that are legitimately defending the population from armed separatist attacks. He says Cameroon President Paul Biya will never tolerate lawlessness, even though he agrees with the women that dialogue should continue as a solution to the crisis in the restive areas of Cameroon.
The head of state has never and can never remain dormant to any claim expressed by his fellow compatriots. It should be noted that in the management of this situation, the security forces were effectively deployed with a constant aim of restoring peace and order.
Unrest began in Cameroon in November 2016 when English-speaking teachers and lawyers in the northwest and southwest called for reforms and greater autonomy. They marched on the streets, criticizing what they called the marginalization of English speakers by French speakers. Separatists took over the protest and demanded the independence of the English-speaking regions from the French-speaking regions of the country. In June, rights group Amnesty International accused both the Cameroon military and separatists fighting for the independence of the English-speaking region of using unnecessary and excessive force. The rights group says civilians are frequently caught up in the violence. The United Nations reports that hundreds of thousands have fled for their lives to the bushes and towns in the French-speaking regions. At least 20,000 have crossed over to Nigeria. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Bamenda.
The UN Refugee Agency warns more than 1 million Ethiopians who were displaced by violence in southwestern Ethiopia, including those who have returned, are suffering from extreme deprivation and are in need of life-saving assistance. For VOA, Lisa Schlein has this report from Geneva.
Conflict between ethnic communities over dwindling resources has sent more than 1 million people fleeing for their lives since April. Most are living in schools, hospitals, and makeshift shelters in the border areas of the Southern Nations, Nationalities, and Peoples region and the Oromia region of Ethiopia. The UN Refugee Agency reports the displaced are in dire need of basic relief, including food, water, blankets, and cooking supplies. It warns many IDPs are at risk of serious health problems and disease outbreaks with the approach of heavy seasonal rains. It says they urgently need plastic sheeting and warm clothing. UNHCR spokesman Babar Balor says people continue to flee the conflict zones. At the same time, he says more than 200,000 people have returned to their areas of origin. He tells VOA some people are reluctant to return for fear violence will break out again.
Some of the monitoring that we have done, it highlights that communities are still afraid. They are worried. At times, there's nothing left to go back to. So that's very important for us to make this call that for the remaining more than 600,000 displaced, people should be the one who are deciding when to go back to their places of origin.
Balor says it also is important that those who have returned to their homes, lands, and farms be helped to rebuild their lives. In all cases, he says returns must be voluntary and be conducted in safety and dignity. He says the UNHCR and its partners urgently need more than $21 million for the humanitarian operations over the coming 12 months. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Wherever two or more meet, you will find a border. Whether that border is between nations or cultures or individuals, it challenges us to discover ourselves through an encounter with another. That's the idea behind New York University's Translucent Borders project. For the second part of our look at Translucent Borders, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke to some of these artists about the borders they discovered within the group and within themselves.
That's the Gil master, Valerie D. Naranjo, in Ghana, playing her instrument and singing in Lobri Brifo, no less, for some of her fellow team members on the Translucent Borders project. As a Native American woman playing a West African instrument traditionally played only by men, Naranjo embodies the very spirit of this enterprise.
When I first traveled to West Africa, I was passionately in love with the music, and I just wanted to trust. I'm not only willing to trust, but I want to trust you. The instrument that I play, the djil, is a border-crossing instrument. The people who play it, they are always speaking of borders. They cross the borders freely.
That's 18-year-old Angela Ambrosini of Germany playing a nickel harpa duet with her father, Marco Ambrosini of Italy. The nickel harpa is an ornate wooden 16-stringed instrument from the Italian Renaissance that is bowed like a violin but played with keys like an accordion. Many musicians and dancers strive to cross the border between themselves and the audience in a sort of artistic communion. But Ambrosini is far more keen to make magic with her fellow musicians, whatever their tradition.
When you play together, you're all together in the circle. It's very intimate. Your heart is beating so hard because of the energy that's there. So much more than just what you feel when you're in the audience.
That's Sule Imoro, a traditional Ghanaian singer and dancer, playing the talking drum. Its powerful African rhythms seem worlds away from the delicate European melodies of Angela's nickel harpa.
But in the end, sometimes we improvised together, and that was really beautiful, pure power in the room. You can really get very delicate with the nickel harpa, but also the African drums really try to convince you, yeah, get wild, give me more.
It sounds very romantic.
Yes, it is. Music is all about that.
For the noted Palestinian singer, composer, and activist Amal Mroukous, music can also be about commingling between distant cultures. Translucent Borders paired her with choreographers and dancers in Cuba to create an entirely new work, and she was delighted to sing Guantanamera with her Cuban colleagues on stage in New York in both Spanish and Arabic.
Guantanamera, Guajira, Guantanamera, Cuba, Guantanamera.
But for Mroukous, music is also a way to assert and celebrate her own Palestinian culture and the political struggles of her people. She declined to perform on stage with Yair Dalal, an Iraqi-born Israeli Jew and a virtuoso of the oud. Mroukous didn't want to give American audiences the impression that Israelis and Palestinians are in harmony when they're not.
This won't stop the bloodshed if I sang with him. Yair is a great artist. I would love that Yair come and march with me in demonstration against attacking Gaza. And then we will sing together.
Yair Dalal believes that collaboration and fellowship between artists should prevail over political borders.
There is a conflict between Israelis and Palestinians, but there is no conflict between me and you, especially artists. We are the people to make this bridge.
Yet another approach to borderland encounters is taken by Meriga Aboubakari, the traditional singer and dancer we hear playing its gonje with all his new friends as he prepares to journey back home to Ghana.
My culture, in the art, you can always blend the anger and love, mix it, and to come up with something positive, the cross borders. When I've come to blend myself, I come there with some joy. Then we are laughing and playing and do all that. By the end of the whole thing, you will say, oh, my brother, please come closer. You embrace. So I have not forgotten the pains, but I think I now understand.
Just as no one factor determines how a person or group approaches a border, there is no one right or wrong way to relate to whomever you meet at that border. Andy Tierstein originated the Translucent Borders Project. He says the core challenge for the artists on these trips has been simply to learn and to share. We purposely made this a question mark, says Tierstein, not an exclamation point. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
This is James Butte, Managing Editor and host of VOA's Daybreak Africa show. Join us Monday through Friday at 03, 04, 05, and 0600 hours UTC as we bring you the latest Africa news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of Daybreak Africa through our mail segment by sending your comments to daybreakafrica at voanews.com. That's Daybreak Africa right here on VOA Africa.
This is The Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Impuga and music from our African collection, and that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Juna, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. But first, seed and crop improvement organizations are making strides toward mitigating the effects of drought and malnutrition by producing adaptable seed varieties. Some of their products were on display at the recent Harare Agricultural Show. For VOA, Adi Gondo gives us more on the story from the Zimbabwean capital, Harare.
Harvest Plus organization, which has a number of offices in Africa and works with three UK groups and Zimbabwe's government, is transferring the technology of biofortification to smallholder farmers. It has released nutritionally enhanced maize seed along with beans enriched with iron and zinc. Maize is the staple crop in Zimbabwe. Incidentally, 20% of children under 5 suffer from vitamin A deficiency, and one out of every three kids is anemic. Harvest Plus official Sakila Gudita speaks on the seed variety.
Harvest Plus has a number of offices in Africa. We've got offices in Zambia, where we're promoting vitamin A maize or vitamin A potatoes. And we also have an office in Zimbabwe, which is where we are. And in Zimbabwe, we're promoting vitamin A maize, vitamin A sweet potato. We're just starting on that. And we also have iron beans. And our iron beans is rich both in iron and in zinc. Then we have an office as well in DRC, where we are promoting vitamin A cassava and iron bean.
The new maize variety is orange instead of the traditional white. It is also drought tolerant, and Kudita says that's one prerequisite for its release. Drought resistance is ideal for the erratic rainfall patterns in Zimbabwe's farming regions and for Africa as a whole. Harvest Plus field officer Lawrence Mjere speaks on the number of farmers which the organization has reached since the organization started working in Zimbabwe in 2015.
In the first year, we covered 24,000. Then that is 2016, 2017. I think we covered around 40, that should be around 34. And 2017-18, this coming season, we are targeting 260,000 farmers.
Joyce Jacobs is a farmer in Zimbabwe's rural Bindura area who sees the benefits of growing the vitamin A-enriched orange maize.
Orange maize, I've got a bit of experience. That's because I've been a few years working with Harvest Plus. So what I learned on the project of orange maize, first thing, orange maize, inside of the orange maize there is a vitamin A about our health. Right. The yield of Harvest Plus is so high than white maize.
Okay.
Then my choice of orange maize, it's a short season, about 90 days, so you're going to harvest your crop better than white maize. Because white maize, you can very busy become a transport to go to GMB, 120 days, 130 days for harvesting. That is a long process. Okay. Right now, I've got the green maize in my garden, which is around 4 weeks now. So it's a very good crop.
What remains is for commercial seed companies to take up the distribution of a seed variety which is set to compete with current maize seed varieties. They do have the challenge of convincing the public to switch to a different color of a food that they grew up eating. Reporting for VOA, this is Adi Gondo from Harare.
It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Impuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. As Europe nations battled in the Nations League, it was Africa Cup qualifiers across the continent. Liverpool's forward Mohamed Salah scored twice, provided two assists, and missed two penalties as Egypt beat Niger 6-0 in a 2019 Africa Cup of Nations qualifier. It was a perfect start for Egypt after their exit from the World Cup. In Nairobi, 10-man Kenya held on to beat Ghana 1-0 on Saturday. In other results, Nigeria were emphatic 3-0 winners against the Seychelles. And next year's Nations Cup hosts Cameroon were held to a 1-1 draw away to Comoros. Both South Africa and Uganda succumbed to goalless draws at home to Libya and Tanzania respectively. 2012 African champions also drew 0-0 away to Namibia. The 12 groups winners and runners-up secure places at the 2019 Nations Finals, except for Group B, where host Cameroon and the highest-placed other team are both qualified. Elsewhere, Arsenal striker Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang hit a vital equalizer for Gabon in their 1-1 draw against Burundi in Libreville. Mozambique and Guinea-Bissau drew 2-2 in Maputo. Later on Sunday, South Sudan hosts Mali in Group C. Senegal, Ivory Coast and DR Congo also are playing later Sunday. Meanwhile, the Council of Southern African Football Associations, COSAFA, has confirmed that its president, Dr. Philip Chiyangwa, will replace Kalusha Bwalya on the CAF Executive Committee. Bwalya was banned for 2 years by FIFA for violating FIFA's code of ethics. In tennis, Naomi Osaka won the U.S. Open after an angry Serena Williams accused the umpire of being a thief in some of the most dramatic scenes at the Grand Slam final. Williams was given a game penalty for the outburst, which followed a racket smashing and another court violation as Osaka won 6-2, 6-4 in New York. Osaka, who is 20, became the first Japanese to win a Grand Slam. In the men's singles final, Juan de la Potro takes on Novak Djokovic on Sunday. In boxing, Sean Porter beat Danny Garcia by unanimous decision to win the vacant WBC welterweight title also in New York. Both fighters are former world champions, had over the past 2 years lost to current WBA champion Keith Schumann. Finally, at the IAAF Continental Cup Ostrava 2018, Emmanuel Korir of Kenya lived up to his billing as favorite in the men's 800 meters as he and his African teammate Nigel Amos of Botswana ensured overall victory in finishing first and third, respectively. Korir, who had clocked the fastest time of the season so far at the Diamond League in London in July and took the IAAF Diamond League title in Brussels on August 31st, won in 1:46.50, but he was pushed to the line by Team America's Clayton Murphy, who took a second place. And that's it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Now back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent.
Kidogo. Oh, oh, hey. Wakinita buzi ni chune, tena ringa kidogo. akicheza kupitiliza, wanasemaga katamshi. Akicheza na nimaliza, alinangata matamshi. Kamependeza kupitiliza, wanasemaga katamshi. Akicheza na nimaliza, alinangata matamshi. Singida Dodoma, ma, 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 ma. Mtwara na Kigoma, ma, 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 ma. Singida Dodoma, ma, 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 ma. Mtwara na Kigoma, ma, 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 ma. Mad girl, nyuka upendezi, punja kabati. Inuka na uchezo, kone wachati.
Lala kifu one, baby data. Usikie moyo wangu vile unavyoteta. Nikikupa mambo fun, unacheka. Kasauti kachumba, unabweka.
Lala kifu one, baby deka. Usikie moyo wangu vile unavyoteta. Nikikupa mambo fun, unacheka. Kasauti kachumba, unabweka.
So let me say, wakinita buzi ni chune. Tena ringa kidogo. Wapiga miruzi wanune. Ongeza mwembe mikogo.
Kupitiliza, wanasemaga katamshi. Akicheza na nimaliza, alinangata matamshi. Kamependeza kupitiliza, wanasemaga katamshi. Akicheza na nimaliza, alinangata matamshi. Singida Dodoma, ma, 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 ma. Mtwara na Kigoma, ma, 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 ma. Singida Dodoma, ma, ma, ma.
Gonna love.
And that was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of The Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's One Man's Point of View with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. The Beijing Summit on the Forum for African-China-African Cooperation, FOCA, and it is time to reflect on what transpired and what was achieved. In the first place, it was recognized by all that this forum represented a landmark in China-African cooperation. Significantly, all African states except one, Swaziland, has full diplomatic relations with the People's Republic of China, which means that they accept the one China policy. Prior to the opening of the conference, some African states paid official state visits to China, and in the course of the summit, in the side meetings, there were many bilateral negotiations, and in the end, 37 countries signed bilateral relations. It is also important to note that in the closing addresses of President Xi and President Ramaphosa of South Africa, the African coordinator, they summarize in a concise way the win-win policy in China-African relations. On the broad level, and what was significant to many, was that President Xi pledged a new $60 billion fund for Africa. And this was seen by many Africans as helping them in their economic development. President Xi also announced that China would implement 8 major initiatives with the African countries in fields such as industrial promotion, infrastructure, connectivity, trade facilitation, and green development in the next few years. Beyond these achievements, it is important for Africans to take a broad overview of China's relations with Africa. Even though there are Africans who may have been edgy about this new relationship, it is important for them to compare China's less than one century relations with Africa and their relationship with Western imperialism and colonialism. Only when they do that will they be able to have a balance in assessing the present trend in China-African relations. Of course, there are from time to time incidents which may worry all Africans, like what happened recently in Kenya when a Chinese national made some vulgar representative statements to Africans. But that was handled quickly, and he was expelled from China. We also have a situation where Chinese fly-by-night investors have been able to spoil the relationship between China and Africa. But these should be put in a context no one has said or proved that China is practicing or intends to practice institutional racism. But I would like to have a broad view. During the 18th and 19th century, British foreign policy was characterized by the concept of balance of power, where the British government was trying to make the international system stable. And here Africans have a role to play. We live now in a very dangerous world, a world where we cannot determine whether the rule of law convention established by the United Nations Charter will last, when the means of abrupt tariff declarations, in the means of individual, not through the UN, sanctions, not only sanctions, but sanctions, secondary sanctions. So it is prudent for Africans to maintain this kind of balance and to see China as an opportunity for them to maintain their sovereignty. President Ramaphosa made in two occasions a concern to the world. He noted that Africans can think for themselves, and he rejected those distractors who are warning Africans to beware of China. China, he said, has been a friend of Africa. And this is a lesson that Africans should take forward with them as they try to develop and learn from their relationship with China. At the end of the day, it will be beneficial to the African continent. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, Managing Editor Shaka Sali, Reporter Douglas Impuga, Producer Saida Hamdoun, and our engineer for today, Tiang Wang, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, if it has to take the goat to drive away a stranger, then the dog has to bear the blame. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The enduring defeat of ISIS remains a top priority for the United States. The U.S.-led global coalition to defeat ISIS is leading stabilization efforts that consolidate military gains, restore basic essential services, and enable Syrians to voluntarily and safely return to their homes in Raqqa and other former ISIS strongholds. Assistance includes explosive hazard and rubble removal, providing clean water, rehabilitating electricity networks, and other basic necessities. Since April, the United States has elicited approximately $300 million in contributions and pledges from coalition partners to support immediate stabilization and early recovery initiatives in areas liberated from ISIS in northeast Syria, including a generous contribution of $100 million by Saudi Arabia and $50 million by the United Arab Emirates. As a result of these generous contributions and other factors, State Department spokesperson Heather Nauert announced the U.S. will redirect $230 million in stabilization funds for Syria, which have been under review. This decision does not represent any lessening of U.S. commitment to our strategic goals in Syria, stressed Ms. Nauert. President Donald Trump has made clear that the U.S. is prepared to remain in Syria until the enduring defeat of ISIS, and the U.S. remains focused on ensuring the withdrawal of Iranian forces and their proxies. We believe, said Ms. Nauert, that neither of these events will happen without irreversible progress toward a political resolution of the conflict, in accordance with UN Security Council Resolution 2254. This decision does not affect U.S. humanitarian assistance. The United States is the largest single humanitarian donor for the Syrian response, providing more than $8.6 billion in humanitarian assistance since the start of the crisis for those displaced inside Syria and the region. The U.S. will also continue to work with its international partners towards the achievement of a peaceful resolution of the Syrian conflict under a UN-led political process. The Syrian people deserve a country free of war, human rights abuses, and terrorism.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.